My ambition after that trip to the Highlands was simply to see if Tasmania could make a really good single malt whisky.
We don't expect everyone to like these wines, so yes, there's some risk.
Drink more sherry, because that's when you can really educate yourself on what happens in maturation.
The thing is with Australian natives, you put them in a gin, the aftertaste invariably is just bitter and unpalatable.
I think the Irish whisky landscape is going to be wildly different over the next 5 years.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits, and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. Founded in 2005 in Beechworth, northeast Victoria, Bridge Road Brewers is currently celebrating its 18th birthday. This is a significant milestone for any business, let alone a craft brewer, and it's particularly momentous for Bridge Road, which is currently poised to open a brewpub venue in East Brunswick, Melbourne, following a successful $1.5 million crowdfunding campaign in 2022. Founder Ben Krause is with us this episode for a really interesting discussion about the challenges of remaining relevant in a fiercely competitive market in which the drinker is always on the lookout for new and different. Well, Ben Krause, thanks so much for joining us on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Mate, it's 18 years for Bridge Road Brewers, a pretty significant milestone, and I was actually just thinking to myself that there aren't that many breweries in Australia that have made it to 18 years and stayed independent.
Yeah, there's a handful. There are some others. There are plenty of breweries before I kicked off my thing in Beechworth, but yeah, there aren't that many around, and being old or having longevity in the craft beer scene can work against you at times as well, so it's always a challenge to stay relevant and easy to stay independent, but harder to keep the relevance up in a market that's sort of chasing new and different, as, you know, the reason it exists is because of that. So it's always a challenge.
Back in the day, you used to sort of talk proudly about how big the core range portfolio was, and there were some real classic styles in amongst that portfolio. Have you kind of held on to those beers? If people come visit you to the brew pub, you know, can they still try, you know, Hefeweizen and some of these styles that are very out of fashion? Or have you had to really focus a little bit more given the changed market over recent years?
We still have a rather extensive core range of beers. We don't have Hefeweizen at the moment, to the dismay of some visitors. I went to the physio 2 days ago, and before the physio started trying to fix my annoying problem with a nerve in my back, he said, "Before I start, I have a question to ask." And I'm like, "Yeah, what?" I'm like, "Oh, what's this going to be about?" And he said, "When are you bringing back the chestnut pilsner?" I'm paying for this time. Let's get on with the nerf trick. I often get questions like that. So there are a few that aren't in the core range for various reasons. But, you know, when we produce a batch of beer, it's 2,500 liters. So Hefeweizen is a good example of a beer that doesn't like packaging unless it's bottle conditioned. Wholesale market has proven in Australia that it really doesn't work on any scale. But that said, we have a 300-liter. Pilot kit here, and we try to roll through some classic styles and some new and interesting things on that, so that our tap room has, we have 20 taps of different beer here in Beechworth, different styles, as good as any, you know, tap room that you could go to. Hefeweizen's probably one that misses out a bit. We have a few lagers from time to time, but generally, you know, core range includes, we do have an outsider lager, which is sits somewhere between a Pilsner and a Helles, just our own sort of style of lager. We make an XPA, yellow and hoppy, and I guess a leaner, aromatic, modern style of Australian pale ale. I guess it fits if you had to put it into a style category. Beechworth Pale Ale is our number one focus and our number one seller. So that's more of a somewhere between that Australian style of pale ale and an American style of pale ale. And then Celtic Red is a beer that continually gets a gold medal in any awards competition we enter it in.
Great beer.
Robust porter. Yeah, it's sort of the slightly overlooked beer, but whenever anyone drinks it, they always say, "Why don't I drink this more often?" But it's malty, it's not hoppy. But yeah, that's still part of our core range, and we have sales enough to keep that going. We've got an alcohol-free beer. So I think core range is probably 6 or 7 beers. Our IPA Bling and our Little Bling, another one that's probably kicked off the that range, that family of beers where you have a little version of something and the normal version of something. That's something we were sort of leading at the time when we released Little Bling. Yeah, so we do have a big range, and then we have a rotating seasonal sour and a rotating seasonal IPA that's every 2 months for each of those.
And what's been the market response to those? Because obviously those two series are, you know, very much playing into hopefully what a lot of consumers seem to be looking for at the moment.
Yeah, the market response is good. It's always just trying to work out what the demand is going to be is the biggest challenge, and acknowledging, you know, we've been innovative with plenty of things, but there are plenty of other people that have a sour series of beers before us and since us as well. So I think in the competitive nature or the competitive space of Australian craft beer, if you're an innovator, you only get a small window of access to that market before other innovative breweries come on board. And then before you know it, that market that looks to be a large or an undersupplied part of the market quickly becomes oversupplied. But those sour series, we've learned to not release them as often in the wintertime because people are looking less for a new sour beer, so it takes a longer time to sell through it. Stable, so it doesn't worry us that it takes a bit, you know, a couple of months to sell through it. They're not going to get any worse. And the same with the IPA series, you know, there's 6 months of the year that are really productive for selling beer and 6 months that are a lot quieter. So we sort of ramp up the releases into spring and summer and when people are up and about and spending money and exploring and then slow it down a bit when people batten down the hatches in winter.
What about Mayday Hills? I sort of got the sense that maybe you didn't get as much traction on that as you would have liked, but there was a fairly recent Mayday Hills Saison, I believe, that came out in the last 12 months at least.
So Mayday Hills range was sort of inspired by a trip I did to Florida to a Shelton Brothers Festival and got to taste Brettanomyces fermented beers that were made in American oak fooders. I saw that as a trend, and it was something that I really enjoyed personally to drink. Those beer styles really interesting. Not too dissimilar to an India Saison, I would say, you know, textural hoppy beers that had this interesting mix of yeast esters and texture and hop aroma and flavour. I think the Brettanomyces side of it made those beers a little divisive, and the sour series that we have now in cans was a reaction to that trend in the market. We were with the Mayday Hills range of beers, often the idea behind it was to reflect something that was from Mayday Hills, which is the old name for the area that Beechworth's in. So that whether that was collaborating with a chef or a local grower of produce or a winemaker, anything along those lines, just a local influence. And, you know, building that nuanced influence into a beer that has texture and character. I would say the market in general was looking for something more obvious and clear and easily identifiable, whereas those beers were designed to be a bit more textural and balanced and layered and harder to understand, I guess is the best way to put it.
Rather than just boysenberry sour,
yes.
You know, does what it says on the tin. You know what you're going to get
exactly.
From it, right?
It's sour, yeah. It's red. You know, we make a beer that might have just the right amount of mandarin or green tea or something like that, and you've had this playing of flavours, and the reaction from the audience who are looking to buy these beers are like, I can't taste mandarin, or I can't, it's not sour, you know, just really clear, which is fine. So we acknowledge that, you know, to push sales volumes, if you make a beer that has mandarin in it, you better be able to give it to your kid and smell it and say that smells like mandarins, you know, that identifiable, still in balance and still nice to drink, but not nuanced and subtle, I guess is the answer to that. So we do continue to release Mayday Hills beers. So we've done a creek. We do once a year. We have locally harvested cherries, so we pick them ourselves this year, put them directly into barrel and do a 12-month aging of a wort on top of spontaneous fermented cherry beer. So it's no cool shit, but we just let the yeast and bacteria on the cherry do the job of fermenting that beer. So anything we do in oak or sort of have mixed fermentation, we put under the Mayday Hills range. And it's not a huge part of what we do, but it's certainly an interesting part, and there's definitely a market for it. We charge a premium. You know, if you buy one of those 750ml retail, they're $30. But I really feel it's worth the $30. If you spend $30 on a bottle of wine, it should be a good experience. And I think if you spend $30 on a bottle of beer, it should be a bloody good experience. And I think we're putting, you know, worthy experiences into that $30 price bracket.
What about, you know, the old Chevalier Saison and Beer de Garde? They obviously don't exist in that old form anymore, but do they still make an appearance? They were such great beers, such great expressions of classic styles.
Yeah, we re-brewed some Beer de Garde late last year, I think, for an event in the 300-litre system. We put it into keg only. You know, it was great to be able to have that beer again, and particularly people who'd experienced it in the past, they're like, oh, thank God this is back, even if it's just for a limited experience. Particularly the Saison, when we first brought that to market, it was in, you know, every one of the best restaurants in Melbourne on their list, and probably quite a few in Sydney as well. The most regular customers I remember for Saison was probably Rockpool in both, but there's Rockpool Sydney and Rockpool Melbourne. They would be ordering every week and having that on their list, and that was, you know, quite an honour to be on these high-end restaurants. Then we saw we were the only one offering, you know, regular Saison. We were the only brewery in Australia producing it not as a seasonal for a long time. Temple came on and put one in a bottle, and I had that as a regular beer for a number of years. So we were the longest producer of Saison in Australia for a while, but we've since wound back regular production of that. And now when we've been doing it, we've gone away from the cleaner example of it, so that's a single yeast strain, and we've gone to a mixed culture release. So we have released it under Mayday Hills as a Saison with a different label and I guess a more complex version of that beer. Those restaurants we're selling to were probably one of only two craft beers on the list. Now if you go to a restaurant, there's probably a good restaurant. There should be six craft beers on the list, probably IPA heavy, maybe no theatre.
Four pale ales.
Yeah, four pale ales. You know, purchasing often price-driven rather than, you know, the story that the beer tells and selling at the price it needs to be, you know. They moved away from only lagers and really great wine list and only lagers to, yeah, a few pale ales and an IPA, but, yeah, price-driven decision-making often the case. Maybe not, but sometimes that's how it comes across.
Do you get frustrated at all? You know, you're a very creative person and there's a sort of a purity about what you've always done with brewing that, you know, the market sometimes has other ideas than the sort of ambitions that you have for some of these products.
Yes and no. I kind of think the market is the market, and sometimes it'd be nice. I think it'd be nice if the market, particularly in the wholesale market, that wasn't so focused on price, but that's sort of the industry is doing of its own. There's lots of price competition. But, you know, in all honesty, Bridge Road is doing lots of things. We have core beers. We've been innovative since forever. You know, we talked about Saison. We've also got Australia's oldest IPA, believe it or not, with Bling. It's been in continual production.
You should be making more of a song and dance about that.
Yeah. But I think if you can focus on one thing really well and do that really well, there's a market there. So despite Saison for us falling off the radar, here comes Bridge Road with, you know, 20 beers on their portfolio, eight of them in core, seven in core. There's these limited releases, and they do a Saison, which might be in a 750ml bottle, which is likened to something from Topher at Wildflower, and they've got room on their list. You know, you have someone like that who's focused on only those products, and there's definitely a market for those products. It's probably just, you know, fair that someone who focuses only on Saison last year is probably a good example, not only Saison, but that style of beer and those style, and that's their wheelhouse, that the market chooses them over us. So I wouldn't say that the market doesn't like complex beers. I would say breweries have become even more specialised in that, and it's probably pushed out those brewers who only dabble in that space or have a broad range. It's hard to be known for more than one thing. You can go through the main brewers in Australia who've been around for a while, or the ones who have done exceptionally well and grown and sold on. If you think of Stonewood, they're known for Packer. Bolter are known for XPA. It doesn't matter how good their IPA or their lager is. If you looked at their sales and production numbers, there's the one thing that you get known for, and that's the one thing you focus on. Yeah, so I think, you know, that nature of focus and the broadening of the industry doesn't mean that those markets have gone. They've just been taken up by someone who's got probably a clearer focus and better understanding of that place and that category. And that's when they, you know, when they go and pitch to restaurants as their focus, and they're going to take the spot of Saison, because the Bridge Road sales reps probably spend their more time in the pub trying to get a beer on tap than they have for restaurant focus. I hope that answers the question.
Absolutely, it does. And it does sort of seem like you guys in recent years have really tried to put a lot of effort into heroing Beachy Pale as your flagship and getting some good traction, you know, in the Gabs poll and those sorts of things?
Yeah, we have a lot of confidence in that beer. We deliberately make sure it doesn't taste like another Australian pale ale that fits that pack ale, XPA. You know, there's a whole range of beers that sort of almost now become interchangeable. I see beers that are made for, they feel like they've been made on a budget for a price point. Often I see them as almost a, I won't say a rip-off, but they're trying to emulate a Pacific Ale from Stone and Wood's success, which is quite, at essence, is a really delicious beer, but it's quite simple. It's aromatic, bitterness is low, malt profile is pretty, there's nothing challenging about that beer. It's very simple and obvious. Again, I talk about that consumer thing with sour beer. It's obvious. It's obviously hoppy. It's obviously not bitter. It's easy to drink and cleansing. There's no malt complexity to it. It's a very light beer. Beechworth Pale Ale is not in that category, and we're not trying to make it be another one of those beers, because there's probably 50 of them in Australia, and Big Brewers, Pirate Life Southwest Ale probably fits that category. Is it called Southwest or South?
Southwest Pale.
Yeah, that fits that category really well. Four Pines have got their Pacific Ale now that's sort of slotting into that space. And seeing it, you go into a pub now, then they're probably mostly contracted. You'll have a heap of lagers, and then you'll probably have three of those yellow, aromatically hopped, low bitterness Australian craft pale ales. But Beechworth Pale Ale doesn't sit in that category. We really want it to sit in a line above that in terms of quality, complexity, be a little bit challenging, but also, you know, a satisfying pint at the pub. I think you should be able to see that it's different. So when I talked about those taps before, it's not going to be yellow. And we've learnt through consumer preference not to make it have too much caramel malt flavour. So it probably looks like it's going to taste like a caramel malt bomb, but it doesn't. So it's obvious that that beer is different in a pub that has lagers and Aussie pale ales. There's, I think, 7 or 8 different hop varieties in that beer. So there's a much more complex hop profile than you would expect in these other beers that are made at a price point. Maybe you have 2, I would guess, maybe 3. And they'd be going for the punchiest ones that don't really offer layers of complexity, but they offer, you know, explosive flavour at a 2 gram a litre addition or something, which is quite smart if you're trying to hit a price point and get that obvious impact for a consumer. Then consumers really want to feel like they can identify something as different, and they can identify it clearly. Use an analogy from the wine market. If you look at the Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc, it's obviously tropical when you smell it. It's fruity. It tastes fruity. It finishes with no finish. You know, it's easy to consume. There's no challenge to it. It's very simple and obvious. And it's probably, you know, the most popular wine over the bar or in Australia or to take home as well. That style of Cloudy Bay style Sauvignon Blanc or New Zealand style Sauvignon Blanc. And I liken a lot of this Australian style pale ale is moving into that. If I had to compare it to a wine, I'd say that's what it is. But I'd like to say Beechworth Pale, maybe it's in Chardonnay territory. It's a bit more body. It's a bit more complexity. It's not easily. You can't just grab another beer from next to it and say, oh, it's the same. We can just drink this one instead. Whether you like it or not, it's going to be a little bit different to other beers on the market.
Has it been for an evolution over the years as well? Those 7 different hops that you mentioned, how recently have you kind of settled on that recipe?
We're probably transitioning a couple out and trying to get, in terms of, we don't want to be adding more hop per litre than we do at the moment, because as everyone knows, times are pretty bad when it comes to margin. There are no margins anymore. So trying to make that beer as cost effective as possible, but keep it what it is. So for us, rather than adding more hops, we're looking to change a couple of the varietals in there to have more bang for your buck, so to speak. And we've definitely, with all our beers that are hoppy, dialed down the IBUs on that beer, not to the territory I was talking before. It still sits as probably around 30 IBUs for that beer. You know, there'd be plenty of IPAs on the market that are popular that are probably less bitter than our pale ale. 30 IBUs isn't particularly bitter, but it probably used to sit at around 40. So we've wound that back just to, I guess, increase drinkability to the majority of people who don't enjoy so much bitterness or perhaps aren't accustomed to it as well.
Looking at what the business has been through, obviously a big crowdfunding effort, announcing the venue in Brunswick East, it's obviously been a big couple of years. What's the latest with the Melbourne venue? Because I think originally it was due to open late last year, but I think I just saw you announce that it's coming up in the next few months, so a little bit behind the schedule that you had in mind.
Yeah, I think no one would have held us to our original schedule. So the project in Brunswick is part of a larger build. So we're fitting into a larger build project. So we're on the back of that. So we've started our works in there a month ago, I think now, and we're scheduling to be open in September. That's sort of where a lot of my focus is at the moment, certainly where all the businesses' funds are being redirected to. So, yeah, that's all coming ahead and looking really exciting. It's a totally different offering, I guess, in terms of visual experience to Beechworth. We certainly didn't try to take old-worldy Beechworth and insert it into a modern building in Melbourne, so we've got a fresh approach on the place. It's something that I've looked at doing for a long time. We've been offering, beer and hospitality here in Beechworth for nearly two decades, particularly on the food front. It's something that is only, I would say, in the capital cities of Australia, probably something that is less than 10 years old. I don't know what you feel like in Sydney, but a place we can go and have a sit-down meal in a brewery and have beer on tap in a hospitality venue that's perhaps not in a industrial zone is something we've been doing here for a long time. As rustic as our place is, it's not in an industrial zone. So I always thought to myself, we're quite busy in Beechworth. We attract people. Competition is coming. I mentioned that before with a brewery in every suburb and every town or two or three. I was like, damn, I wish I could do what I do here in Beechworth in Melbourne or Sydney, because for a long time no one was offering that. And now we're seeing that come about. But I think it's relative. It might seem common, but it's relatively new to see that venue that's open 7 days a week that you can go have a meal and sit down and drink beer in. And it's a production venue as well. I was in Hawke's Brewing recently when I got delayed in Sydney for something. And I thought, wow, that's a great example of somewhere that's a big production place. It's also got a great hospitality offering. Isn't so common.
No, there aren't. And I'm actually sitting around the corner from those guys as we speak. It is quite unique in Marrickville to actually have a venue that A, has its own kitchen, and B, has a fit out of that kind of standard where you feel a bit more like you're in a pub than you do.
Rather than
in
a shed.
In a warehouse or a shed, yeah.
That is something that I've been wanting to do for a long, long time, because it's like, I know how well this works in Beechworth. Imagine if I had a million people living around us rather than 3,500. Obviously, it takes a lot of effort and a lot of financial commitment as well. So the crowdfunding was a way to do that. I've always wanted to stay in control of the business and stay independent and sort of be my own decision maker and not be under the pressure of other people's needs and wants in terms of, and then having to compromise on decision making because of someone needing a return other than myself buying a new bike or, family pressures and holidays and those sorts of things. So that's probably why it's taken a long time to commit to this, but we have now, and yeah, hopefully we deliver something that's different. We're certainly not trying to replicate what we've done. I acknowledge there's, some really great examples. I just mentioned one in Sydney recently. There's plenty of other great venues in Sydney as well. The guys at Stomping Ground have, smashed that model out of the park, I think. They really showed how it could be done. When I think in my mind of how it would be done, they went and did it. Probably they did the best example. They were the first probably to do that really, really well in Melbourne, and they still hold the baton, I think, in terms of that kind of family-friendly, all ages, casual dining experience with great beer made on site and a production. It's not a token, tank of beer in the back corner. It's they're making beer there.
Is that brewery going to make, is it going to be very much the brew pub type scenario where it's making beer just to be drunk on site, or is it going to kind of also be sort of replacing some of Beechworth production for the Melbourne market?
No, I think the focus is definitely, the capacity isn't to have production for the Melbourne market, and the focus is definitely to make beer for that site. We could have opened a tap room and tried to roll out Bridge Road brand without production there, but I kind of feel like, particularly if you want to be committed to the community and provide something for them, having a production of beer on site that they can really attach to as their own in some way, that local support side of thing is really important. So, you can save a whole lot of money and space and rent by not putting a brewery in there. But I think in order to deliver a great example and an authentic example that people can really get around, making its own beer is important. We'll still be pushing Core Range beers from Beechworth down to there, and hoping people choose to drink some of that as well as the beer that's made on site. The idea behind it is that it also boosts brand Bridge Road Brewers' more than just the brew pub. So, you know, that might encourage people to learn more about the brewery. I'm sure there'll be a heap of people that come in there that don't know about Beechworth and Bridge Road Brewers. So, you know, that cross promotion. Or it might encourage them the next time they go to their local bottle shop to pick up Beechworth Pale because they had a great experience at Brunswick and see that as something that they can get around and support.
How has wholesale been for you guys over the last few years? You know, I've spoken with you a few times in the past about how difficult, you know, you've found it, like a lot of breweries do, in Sydney. Are you still pushing on in Sydney? And
yeah, we're still committed to, you know, we've been quite lucky and had great relationships with the major chains in Australia in terms of wholesale packaged beer. We still have strong relationships. That market was always going to become more competitive and price will eventually come into discussion. So we've had a long-term strategy of investing in a sales team to sell beer in larger volumes around Australia so we can keep production up and not be too exposed should one of the bigger chains decide they don't need our beer or the price isn't right in the future. So we're still committed to that. It's still a grind in some markets, and in other markets we do exceptionally well, better than what I thought we would. The market itself, you know, as a whole and wholesale beer is probably that one of the hardest points it's been at for some time. I've probably spoken on this subject in the past, but I think making sure that other brewers really understand the cost of producing a keg and the cost of selling it and the cost of getting that keg back and paying your staff. And, you know, we've got, I think, a staff member hit 14 years with the brewery recently. So, you know, long service leave and all those other things that come into the cost of making a keg of beer that people probably don't focus on. We're seeing a high level of competition that has beer often being purchased by decision makers at a venue at costs that I know are below production costs. Sometimes blows my mind. And I can understand there's motivations for that. It might be people are stuck with stock and they need to move it. It might be people are looking for an exit strategy and they need to have more and more and more tap points to show that their production is up and they've got this much exposure in the market. They might sign a contract that gets beer, comes out of their marketing budget, get beer at cost or below cost. But that in the long term, that, you know, is we're going to see the fallout. We're starting to see the fallout of that already, and we're going to see the fallout of it even more. I think brands that have based their model on this no margin or low margin really will be exposed. This year, unfortunately, it's an expectation from the purchasing person at many venues is, you know, we only purchase at this price. And it's like, well, our prices don't even, that's what it costs us. So we can't sell you beer at that price. We need to go to work and make money and pay our people and everything. But if the guy around the corner has a beer that people see as being just as good for 10% less, then why, you know, it's a hard argument to say, well, you should buy ours because we're not making a big margin. And we are in it for the right reasons and all those things. But, you know, everyone's doing it tough. So often price is what wins. So it's a worrying space at the moment. And you don't have to look far at, you know, if you have that conversation and say, well, okay, how much do you pay for your cheapest draft beer, whether it's from CUB or Lion? It's more than you pay for your craft beer. So that can't be, like, you've got someone making in a month more than this brewery's going to make an entire year or, you know, in a week more than a brewery's going to make an entire year. How can you possibly expect that brewery can sell you beer at a price lower than those guys? But that's just a matter of competition and the market, supply and demand. Unfortunately, that's where it is at the moment. So it does make things tough. It's something I've always banged on about. We've seen breweries come and go over the 18 years that worked off these discount models, and not many of them are still around these days. There are some people that continue to manage business well with, I guess, discount model wholesale beer. I don't know how they manage it, but they seem to. So that's going to be a challenge. I think, you know, the major two brewers have finally managed to get their acquisition strategy right in terms of crushing the rest of the market and dominating taps. And I say that they're two acquisitions. I probably overlooked Four Pines because you see them more up your way than down my way. But Four Pines and Pirate Life in their local markets, those acquisitions they seem to have been able to use as leverage to keep independent craft out of the market. But Stone and Wood and Bolter, we were seeing a big pushback from publicans towards contracts from those majors because the consumer was saying, well, we need craft beer. And, you know, they had Fat Yak or something, and they're like, or Lashes, and they're like, well, that's not craft anymore. And our consumers want something that's got more character and more story to tell. Those big brewers can turn around, you know, individually and say, well, we've got the two best craft beers in Australia, Bolter and Stone and Wood. So now you can sign a contract and just leave the other tap on the end of the bank, or the two taps, which we've generously left for the the rest of the nation to discount against each other in trying to get their beer on tap. Whether or not, you know, the prices that they paid for those breweries will ever pay back their investment, I don't know. But if their goal was to quash the uprise of independent craft, they've probably done a pretty good job of that at the moment. That's how it seems to me, because consumers probably do feel like, well, I'm drinking Bolt or I'm drinking Stone and Wood. You know, I probably wouldn't mind having an IPA or another better option on tap, but, you know, it can differentiate me from the crowd. The flavor is different from the lager that is otherwise on offer. So I don't know what the answer is from an independent brewing perspective to call that out or show what else an independent brewery can offer that venue in terms of, or the consumer, that they go in and say, well, I know you've got those two, but you don't have, you know, Filter XPA, or I'm just trying to think, or Grifter Pale, or when it's the Sydney market, or you don't have Bridge Road Brewers, why is that? You know, you should have them on tap. So somehow empowering the consumer or encouraging the consumer to recognize that those previously independent craft brands are no longer that. And
do you feel like that's gotten harder?
Yeah, just in a short period of time.
Yeah. But the importance of independence, like what I'm saying is, I guess, do you think that consumers care enough?
They'll care when the, you know, you never miss your water till it's gone.
Mm.
You know, I've always banged on about the two major breweries would rather just sell one beer each, you know, have a desert of beers or a heavy and a light like it used to be. There's less marketing people to pay. Well, you probably spend more on marketing, but, you know, it's a less complex model of making money. If you don't have diversity, just sell a couple of products, so work out your prices and your margins and your distribution. You know, you don't have to deal with multiple production locations and inputs and all these sorts of things. And it's only because of independent craft beer that there's been diversity of beer. You know, it won't happen, but if every independent craft brewery was to disappear tomorrow, you'd probably see a melting of, you know, a narrowing of what's available.
Well, let's talk about what else you've got happening this year to mark the 18th anniversary. So there's the release of the Mac 13 B2 Bomber, is that right?
Yeah, B2 Bomber Mac 13.
Okay, so right.
The 13th iteration of that type of beer, I guess. So we have B2 Bomber. It's like version 2.0, version 13.0. It's like Windows 13 sort of thing. That beer is a great point to reflect on the year before. We always try to bring a different aspect into that beer. That's something we've learned. Maybe next year it'll be half the alcohol because we've learned how to cut costs. but this year we use Spectrum a little bit in some beers and really liked how that works. So we bought, it was probably the biggest change in that beer, a hop product called Spectrum, which is like an extract that you can add sort of post-fermentation and give this really fresh hop character. But we just added that on top of a base recipe that was already very hoppy, so give it an extra angle. We acknowledge it. People have really done better than me in cellaring that beer since its inception. So, you know, we're slowly starting to see a really good response from people who are getting together with, you know, the last five back catalog versions. And when we release the 13, they throw a bit of a party and reflect on what each one was like, whether it was hit or miss, and pick their favorite. I think that's really great to see. It's great. You know, a reflection of our own history and people's own history within craft beer. They'll say, I bought the first one. It was my first experience with that style of beer. And, you know, thank you. It's good to hear those stories. So it's a really good, that beer is another really good way to put a line in the sand, reflect on the previous year from all ends of the business, but also from a consumer side as well, and get them to look at Bridge Road and see what it means or doesn't mean to them. You know, never heard of these guys. What's this Mac 13 about? It lets them discover that story.
All right, Ben. Well, happy 18th birthday. Congratulations on everything you guys have done, and hopefully catch up with you for a beer in person at some point.
Cheers, mate.